Bonjour, mesdames et messieurs. Pour la troisième fois, j'aimerais remercier le professeur Beau ainsi que ses collègues qui ont eu la gentillesse de m'inviter ici comme professeur invité. Mon séjour à Paris m'a donné de nombreuses idées pour mon travail et qui ne sera pas heureux d'avoir la possibilité de passer un mois à Paris. Ici, on n'a même pas besoin de beau temps, et comme il y a de si belles bibliothèques comme la bibliothèque de Saint-Geneviève. Malheureusement, mon séjour à Paris ne m'a pas aidé à améliorer mon français. C'est pourquoi je dois m'adresser à vous en anglais à nouveau aujourd'hui. Mais j'espère pouvoir compter sur votre compréhension. Et one more sentence in French. Je ne suis pas marxiste, je suis catholique.
Ah oui, le marxiste, yeah, yeah. Le marxiste était Ulrich Preuss.
Oui, oui, oui.
C'était ça l'opposition qui était intéressante.
And here you can see how liberal he is, yeah, that he has invited me to be his assistant, yeah. Okay, so I would like to talk to you on a problem that has shaken Europe since 2015, and that raises serious ethical, political, and legal challenges to European constitutional democracies, the refugee crisis. When I refer to refugee crisis, I'm fully aware that the crisis the refugees from civil war countries such as Syria and Afghanistan are facing is much more a crisis than the crisis we have to deal with in Europe. Nevertheless, I think the term refugee crisis is appropriate. Let me first expose the paradox between human rights and civil rights that is raised in the refugee crisis. It doesn't happen very often that a radical claim expressed in the protected realm of academic political philosophy and theory finds a correspondence in the actual political praxis. However, Germany witnessed the come-in of around 1 million refugees within 1 year, from summer 2015 to summer 2016. Several thousand per day in autumn 2015, crossing de facto open borders at the Federal Republic. Such a policy of open borders complies with the position of political theorist Joseph Cairns, professor at the University of Toronto. Cairns argues that border control, which excludes people who want to migrate and live in a different country, is incompatible with human rights. This argumentation line is quite common within ethics of immigration. Human rights do not only substantiate a valid claim for support for people in need, moreover, the notions of freedom and equality of people imply a universal right for global freedom of movement. This position, as well as the German policy of open borders, was on the other hand subject to sharp criticism. In a report to the Bavarian state government, the former justice of the Federal Constitutional Court, Udo Di Fabio, accused the Merkel administration of giving away the conditions of statehood by foregoing border control. Moreover, he argued that this proceeding is inconsistent with the democratic principle, since the constitutive people was prevented from deciding on the population composition. So this debate entails several questions. Does the refugee crisis reveal an opposition between universal human rights and particular civil rights? Or does it rather illustrate a conceptual relation which was always inherent to modern liberal democratic tradition and which, however, then can become a dramatic internal challenge for constitutional democracy? Can one even see a paradox for the democratic constitutional state as political order, which indeed builds its legitimacy on human rights and popular sovereignty? In this respect, Sheila Ben Habib employs the notion of a dialectic tension between universal human rights and civil rights, which today is not only visible at the edges of the demos, as she ambiguously remarks. So, in a theoretical investigation, the analysis of paradoxes serves to deepen the understanding of research objects or concepts. At best, this allows for resolving the alleged contradiction. At least it unfolds the tension and makes it transparent. To to do so, on the one hand, the human rights-oriented position of open borders and a far-reaching openness towards refugees and migrants, backed up with arguments of migration ethics, has to be presented. On the other hand, the position of the inevitable necessity of state borders and the consequent exclusivity and particularity of democratic citizenship has to be examined. Finally, the last part is concerned with a mediation between both positions, building here on the German constitutional order, as well as the political praxis handling incoming refugees in Germany. Germany is chosen here because, first, with its basic law, it can indeed be perceived as a prime example of a democratic constitutional state order. And second, because in the light of the refugee crisis, a severe debate in the political and scientific community has erupted. So, but before I will juxtapose these two positions, namely the human rights-based position entailing open borders and an obligation to help, and the civil rights-based position entailing enforcing states' borders, and then we'll look for a somehow dialectical solution in Germany's basic law, first, I have to make some conceptual clarifications. Before I clarify in more detail how I understand constitutional democracy and human rights, I would like to say very briefly what I mean with borders, and especially what I do not mean here. I'm not talking about borders in the sense of limitations of the democratic constitutional states in terms of its problem-solving ability. For instance, there are significant problems to analyze when it comes to the logic of competitive democracies and the structural dominance of short-term interests over long-term and public interests, as for example with regard to the protection of the environment. Moreover, there are serious limitations of constitutional democracies we have to perceive in case the institutional arrangement is not facilitated by officials who have an awareness for their position and act in accordance with the ethical commitments that are demanded by this position. In particular, representatives require an ethos of truthfulness, seriousness, and courage. We do see in our times what happens if the citizenry vote for those politicians who lack this democratic ethos. These problems can and should also be addressed when talking about borders in the sense of limits of constitutional democracy. However, in my talk, borders are literally understood in the spatial sense as state borders here. So what do I mean by constitutional democracy? There's a very nice quote here. The democratic constitutional state is not a construct from a single caste. Its rules do not follow one certain and not only one logic. This insight in the democratic constitutional state stems from Peter Graf Kiemann's Eck, a German political scientist whose work on constitutional democracy is leading the way in this field, to my judgment, and he draws our attention to the fact that we do not only have to analyze democracy as such when we discuss the legitimacy and functionality of Western political systems, but also the constitution and how democracy and constitution interact. Just a remark in parenthesis, as Birkenfelder's works, either Kielmann's ex-works has only been published occasionally in English, and thus he does not play a role in the international debate on democratic theory. I cannot say that I'm aware of everything written in English on this topic, who could so? But in my impression, this German strand of literature, especially the writings of Kielmann's Eck, are as sophisticated as, for instance, the work of Richard Bellamy here, to my knowledge, who's pertinent here in the field. So, in various studies in the fields of history of ideas and political theory, not only in Kielmann's Eck studies, but other scholars as well, the tensions that are so typical for this political order has been worked out. Be that the tension between the democratic and the constitutional principle, or the interplay between representation and popular government, which in the first place allowed for self-governance under the conditions of modern statehood. One should think for a moment why we usually, nowadays, at least in political science we do so, refer to the democratic constitutional state, or in short, constitutional democracy, than rather merely to democracy while pointing to Western political systems. In my view, this has to do with the process of deglorification of the post-1968 paradigm, according to which a Rousseau-inspired idea of direct democracy was en vogue, in combination with the respective claim for democratization of all areas of life. This claim somehow has lost its shine already. So maybe his hand will come out of his grave a little bit more. Yes, you mentioned today that in the Pantheon there is Rousseau and he's waving to us. Okay, so maybe he's waving now a little bit more. Nowadays, in the light of the rise of the populist movements, claiming that only they are the exclusive representative of the true majority, the true people, and thus only they represent the real people's will, I'm even more reluctant to see a point in Rousseau's rather identitarian idea of democracy based on a coherent unity of the people instead of a pluralism of interests. Popular sovereignty is an insufficient response to the question of the legitimacy doctrine of democracy if interpreted as transformation of individual self-determination in a collective subject. I agree with the basic insight that democracy is not a realization of self-determination, but of participation in the sense of an equal right to take part in the regulation of public issues. Thereby, this right is realized in the interplay between elected representatives and represented people. Democracy should, in fact, institutionalize difference, and representative democracy does so by splitting one people into represented and representatives, and by replacing the one united people by the recognition of the variety of groups, worldviews, and interests into which the one people divides. So, Klimaczek. So within democracies, representation institutionalized the idea of a legally bound, temporarily limited, common good-oriented, and accountable public power. Here the constitution comes into play. Democratic order must not be regarded through the prism of one principle, in particular not through the one of popular sovereignty, but as a combination of democracy and constitutionalism. A constitution at the same time constrains and enables the people's will. The will of the majority is constrained in light of rights of individuals and minorities, and is also enabled to act politically in light of the procedures and institutions as rules of the game. The disabling and the enabling function of the constitution complements democracy. And insofar the constitution is given by the people themselves and the pouvoir constituant still upholds the constitution, then constitutional provisions should not be seen as an illegitimate threat to democracy, but as a political sibling. Both form together constitutional democracy. Most modern constitutions include in some way or another rights. Civil rights and human rights. So what is their specific claim of validity? Human rights are characterized by a twofold claim of validity, a moral and a juridical one. The juridical claim of validity is addressed to the world of states. In this respect, as is generally known, human rights on the one hand confer individual rights against the state, formalized in the fundamental rights of national constitutions. On the other hand, human rights are reflected in international law and in regional conventions, as for example, the European Convention on Human Rights. Accordingly, also in these cases, the addressees are states, more concrete, signing states who commit to guarantee the stipulated rights within their dominion. A state which ratifies an international human rights treaty agrees that the guarantee of human rights within its dominion can become a matter where external critique on the state's legal practice cannot be repelled with reference to the exclusive responsibility for inner affairs. Therefore, human rights and their international legal obligation relativize the principle of state sovereignty. So the moral claim of validity of human rights is of different kind. The threefold relation between entitled entity, obligated entity, so the addressee, and the state as guarantor for this legal relation, which is typical for juridical rights, can be reconstructed for the moral dimension as well. Every individual is at the same time entitled and obligated, while the community of humankind is the guarantor of this relation. Humankind can be regarded as a guarantor in the sense that it constitutes the third party, the external norm, which assures the moral reciprocity. In the words of brilliant Ulrich K. Preuss, on whose ideas of human rights I'm here heavily relying, he said, without this external norm, two people cannot enter into a relationship of moral reciprocity because they are not able to agree on a norm which exists outside this relationship. However, the third entity here, humankind, is only an effective guarantor in a moral normative sense. It cannot be a guaranteeing power as the state is, since it doesn't have respective institutional structure. This, in turn, doesn't mean that the moral claim of human rights is pointless. In fact, the stronger the idea of humanity as global community is anchored within people's worldview, their idea of solidarity and their social action, the greater the possibility is to put human rights in practice. This connection was already relevant in Kant's Perpetual Peace, which was groundbreaking not only in this respect. Kant unfolded the idea of a global citizenship based on the conviction that there is a unifying tie between all human beings, entailing that injustice in one place is felt in all. And there's this wonderful quote I won't read, but you can read it at the side. So in fact, it required two world wars and the Holocaust as a rupture of civilization until this understanding of one humanity, whose members are free and equal, found political consensus and precipitated in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The declaration uniquely formulates that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Furthermore, the preamble of the declaration explicitly employs the notion of the human family and the conscience of mankind. So, in face of this claim for equal human rights, the exclusivity of civil rights and the refusal of migrants of controlled borders is criticized as a kind of contemporary feudal system within migration ethics. Accordingly, Joseph Cairns insists, in a world of relatively closed borders like ours, citizenship is an inherited status and a source of privilege. Being born a citizen of a rich country in North America or Europe is a lot like being born into the nobility in the Middle Ages. Hardly any other factor is as determining for life opportunities and well-being as the place of birth. Ayelet Shachar has drawn the catchy image of birthright lottery to describe this circumstance. She reminds us that, and here I will read a longer quotation, for those granted a head start simply because they were born into a flourishing political community, it might be difficult to appreciate the extent to which others are disadvantaged due to the lottery of birthright. But the global statistics are revealing. Children born in the poorest nations are 5 times more likely to die before the age of 5. Those who survive their early years will, in all likelihood, lack access to basic subsistence service such as clean water and shelter, and are 10 times more likely to be malnourished than children in wealthier countries. Many will not enjoy access to even basic education, and those out of school are more likely to be girls than boys. The odds they will either witness or themselves suffer human rights abuses are also significantly increased. And we should add to this list the danger of being killed as civilians in civil wars. we all want the best for our children. If we start to think what it would mean to know that our children would have to grow up in Afghanistan, Iraq, or Syria, we better understand why parents chose to escape the situation and take their children to this outrageous, risk-free journey across the Mediterranean Sea where so many children died. Shahar goes on. It seems unlikely that circumstances of birth would serve today as the core determinants of entitlement to full and equal membership in the citizenry body, given the extent to which it has been rejected in so many other domains of public life. And yet, reliance upon the accident of birth is inscribed in the laws of all modern states and applied everywhere. In fact, the vast majority of the global population has no way to acquire membership except by circumstances of birth. However, other than Karen's, Shahar does neither hold a position of open borders, nor does she declare in favor of a world citizen legal status. We had this discussion 2 weeks ago. What she is claiming is a review of national border regimes based on theories of justice as well as international welfareism in order to diminish the extreme inequities in life prospects, however that system might be shaped. Apart from that, the intuition of a fundamental injustice with view to strict border control can also be caught theoretically with the Rawlsian thought experiment of the original state. Be it that all human beings are in the original state, no individual will, under the wheel of ignorance, vote in favor of impervious borders, since everybody is at risk to be born in a state which does not even provide for basic needs. Instead, one will rather claim a right on freedom of global movement. This idea substantiated in Andreas Cassis' Cosmopolitan Contractualism, a colleague of Switzerland, who inquires critically the justifications offered for a state's right to exclude immigrants and who justifies a moral right to global freedom of movement. Finally, to add a religious Catholic reasoning to this brief overview of positions that shed critical light on the current system of exclusionary borders, one can argue with Pope Francis that the universal validity of human rights implies that earth and its fruits are provided to humanity as a common heritage. From this perspective, the current system of a world of states based on excluding borders appears to be critical. Interestingly enough, already John Locke employed this argumentation line in his first treatise of governments to refuse the traditional feudalistic theory of property. According to Locke, God put the earth in the hands of Adam as a representative of all, not as a representative of the privileged race. The recent remarks of Pope Francis on the refugee crisis are an expression of this position, for instance, when he insisted that the just distribution of the fruits of the earth and human labor is not mere philanthropy, but a moral obligation. As a result, positions based on human rights, theories of justice, and religious considerations build the moral philosophical background of today's debate on refugees. The range of claims encompasses open borders due to a human right on free movement, comprehensive provision of services within refugee camps at the edge of war zones based on a moral duty to help, as well as claims for a fundamentally reform of the global economic and security architecture rooting in notions of international justice. Since the beginning of the refugee crisis in summer 2015, the position of open borders could be heard in the European public debate as well, then most vividly argued for against the backdrop of the horrible death of refugees in the Mediterranean Sea, which caused a moral outcry. Since 2000, approximately 23,000 people died while fleeing, several thousand each year. However, also voices could be heard that insisted that with every moral indignation, the risk is high to prevent oneself from thinking through what must be thought through. This position is usually marked as an expression of an ethic of conviction, the Weberian Gesinnungsethik. Conviction, ethic of conviction, yes, better than.
Éthique de la conviction, yeah, en yeah. France, très cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And is characterized by not taking into account the potentially problematic political consequences of its moral claims. Instead, in the case of an open border position, the abundance of resources, of economic resources, of solidarity with non-citizens, infrastructures, and so forth, is simply presupposed to justify policies of open borders and to denounce positions that stress the legitimacy of borders, which are often even disqualified as racist. Indeed, this express a form of ethic of conviction. Morality then just overtrumps politics. However, in spite of these concerns, the moral claim of validity of human rights must nevertheless be substantial for the democratic constitutional state. Human rights and its fundament, human dignity, can be considered the shared language of humanity on which the community of states politically agreed in the aftermath of the catastrophes of the 20th century. This language is universal because it implies to recognize every human being as a person from which an unconditional claim to respect its dignity is emanating. Indeed, this is reflected in the legitimacy architecture of democratic constitutional states. One could transfer Kant's categorical imperative to the level of political legitimacy. A state is legitimate if it treats humanity in every single person as an end, not as a mere means. What follows from this is an ineluctable normative obligation for states so that human rights are more than mere rhetoric. Doing so, after all, human rights then are indeed trumps for politics. On the other hand, again, even a perfectly justified moral philosophical should does presuppose ability. If one cannot, one is not obligated. Is not this also a legal principle? Impossibilium nulla est obligatio. This holds true for individual ethics as well as for theory of justice, which binds collective actors. How one then actually evaluates the availability of the factors that substantiate ability depends on empirical assessments. What theory can do is then to carve out these factors in the first place and thus to make them accessible for empirical analysis. Doing so, the argumentation comes to a point where the question is whether the claimed ability, namely the fulfillment of demands that arise from universal human rights, significantly depends on state border demarcation, spatial limitations which allow for political limitations. So now I switch to the position of the legitimacy of borders in the democratic constitutional state. The claim of legitimacy of state borders roots in the notion that they are necessary to assure the conditions of existence of political entities. They facilitate to define inclusion and exclusion of membership. This must be differentiated from a Schmittian understanding of the political as an exclusive community based on the ability to determine friend and enemy. Instead, the issue at stake is a securing statehood. State borders are the constitutive feature of modern states whose political order is based on territoriality, monopoly on the use of force, and definable communities, what Georg Jelinek so famously has captured in his three-element theory of the state. State territory, state power of sovereignty, and state's people are the defining elements of the modern state. The modern statist order connects the criteria of personality and territoriality. In the words of legal scholar Klaus Gerdes, the modern state as a territorial entity of power and decision quarters a personal substrate, constitutive people, on a stable territory, state territory, through effective control, state power. and thus combines the formal allocation criteria of personality and territoriality. Therefore, the role of borders is to demarcate state sovereignty internally and externally. Borders are thus not merely to be seen in their territorial dimension, but stand for the state as a container, which guarantees protection through control, social security through welfare systems, as well as freedom and political self-determinacy as democratic constitutional state. German social and political scientists Herfried Münkler and Marina Münkler argue that a border performs a threefold spatial coding. It marks the scope of, first, a legal order with the expectation of political loyalty, second, of an economic order, and third, of national affiliation. And as Ulrich Preuss remarks, this ideal typical model entails a fusion of geographical area, territorial dominion, domestic markets, and cultural identity to a self-contained system. Thereby, the demanding form of the democratic constitutional state is particularly dependent on clear criteria which define who belongs to the political entity. These criteria also enable the members to mutually recognize themselves as part of the political entity, or, as Ernst Wolfgang Böckenförde, what we already discussed last week, put it, to recognize themselves as a relatively homogeneous political community. In his understanding, homogeneity means a socio-psychological condition where the present political, economic, social, and cultural contrasts and interests are bound by a shared conscience of unity, a constantly renewing sense of community. This asks for clarification. Does this refer to a culturally defined idea of nation grounded on ethnic origin, which was prevalent in the authoritarian peak phase of modern nation state, as Dieter Goswinkel researched on? Not for Böckenförde. The nation state is a historically contingent product of Western, Middle European state formation. Its formation conditions can under no circumstances be generalized in democratic theory, in particular not in the sense of a socio-cultural determined idea of a people as a natural organism. From Böckenförde's perspective, homogeneity does neither imply an ethnic uniformity, nor does it constitute a counterterm to pluralism. Instead, democracy requires a consensus on principles that cannot be voted upon within the citizenry. Particularly, free polities rely on a cohesive sense for a shared political identity within citizenship. This sense of belonging, as Ralf Dahrendorf has put it, this sense of belonging triggers not only a feeling of responsibility for the polity, but does also assure the acceptance of majority decisions by minorities, the respect of minority rights by majorities, and not least the acceptance and adoption of material solidarity commitments. The resource of solidarity is linked to the condition of mutual trust within citizenry. Especially in democracies that are characterized by high levels of social benefits and redistribution, and which moreover disburse these benefits to persons who were given access to the state territory independently of their citizenship, solidarity obligations are only made seamless if those who benefit are affiliated to the reciprocity-based community on the long term. Indeed, non-citizens also pay tax and social contributions and thus contribute to the social contract when integrated into the labor market. However, from a democracy theory perspective, a permanent residence entails a right to membership in the citizenship. And the recipients of this right must be its authors on the long term. One could speak here of a democratic spillover of territory admission. If all people who received indefinite admission to a state territory are potential new citizens, the question of admission connects to crucial democratic political issues. These issues must be decided on in a democratic process, including public debate in the society and in parliament, something of which Chancellor Merkel thought there is no time for in face of the given urgencies in 2015. For Ulrich Di Fabio, the former FCCC judge, the point of criticism that there was no democratic political debate in the parliament doesn't go far enough. He insists that the actual policy of open borders by the Merkel administration neglected the fundamental condition of democratic statehood. Quote, if a state can't control the mass entry of people into its territory anymore, its statehood is at risk simply because the constitutive people as well as its commissioned organs run into danger of both overstretching their personal and territorial responsibility to protect and of losing their functionality as welfare state under the rule of law. Even if one doesn't share Di Fabio's position, one has to analyze the reasons why, besides the Willkommenskultur, a culture of welcoming the refugees, and a culture of civic or practice of civic engagement, so many others refused the admission of refugees, even if they didn't experience any negative impacts in their daily lives or were even confronted with refugees. Indeed, from a socio-psychological perspective, it could be argued that the reasons are racism and xenophobia, both still present in modern societies. However, not all who reject the admission of refugees are racists. From a social science viewpoint, the much sharper analysis was provided again by Peter Graf Kiemann-Zeck, who has contributed to this discussion with an anthropologic and democratic theory argument. The want for borders, or limitations in general, is a deeply rooted anthropological constant. If it is falsely condemned as something illegitimate, this in turn results in a firing of populism, what we can see in so many Western states now. The perceived otherness of the incoming triggered worry and feelings of insecurity because people feared a loss of control through the dissolution of borders. This perceived loss of control roots not only in the opening of state borders, but more general in the perception of decaying boundaries in course of globalization when, quote, territory, political dominion, and with that, democratic self-determinacy, economic relations, and cultural identity progressively fall apart, unquote, as Preuss remarked. In this respect, the European Union plays the role of a pioneer, since it already passes through a process of deterritorialization in succession of the establishment of the European single market, which is, not only in Germany, perceived as a loss of control by many citizens. Revealingly, the most important slogans of Brexit supporters were, "We want our country back," and "Take back control," which obviously had stopped the process of an ever-deepening and enlarging European Union. The process of European integration can be described as follows. After a phase of national segregation within the model of a container state, the EU has initiated a turn into a unique construct of a common area of freedom, security, and justice, wherein border control is suspended. Moreover, the introduction of a voting right for EU citizens on a municipal level even dissolved the alleged indissoluble connection between national citizenship and democratic voting rights. The external borders of the EU became, in a way, the new borders of each single member state, historically a very new situation. However, what went wrong in this process is that the political mechanisms to deal with the respective implications, in particular the transfer of a fair distribution of costs into commonly held compromises, were not reliable enough. So, having juxtaposed now the two positions, on the one hand a human rights-oriented position of rather open borders, or at least comprehensive support for refugees, on the other hand a position that stresses the irreducibility of state borders connected to an exclusive democratic citizenship, how now then can these positions be reconciled? Referring to the German Constitution, this issue shall be addressed now in the next step. And interestingly, I think that the German Constitution, the basic law, reveals somehow already a bridge between universal human rights and democratic civil rights. It states that as a fundamental characteristic of a democratic republic, the Constitution is given to the people by the people, that the people is the source of state power, which is in turn, through commissioned democratic institute, mandated democratic institutions, exercised by the people as popular sovereignty. Members of the people are those holding a German citizenship, which connects to an entitlement for all guaranteed fundamental rights encompassing civil rights and human rights. The criteria of citizenship are not aligned to ethnicity or culture, but are legally defined. German citizenship receive all children of German parents and other persons who apply for naturalization and meet the demanded requirements. These requirements were subject to significant change. Since the reform at the end of the 1990s, a residence of 8 years, along with some other requirements, as for instance language skills, qualify for a legitimate claim for naturalization. Based on that, the German Constitution determines the right to vote, access to public office, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, freedom of occupation, and the right to resist as explicit rights of citizens. However, besides these civil rights only accessible to German citizens, the German Constitution also guarantees human rights. General freedom of action, freedom of opinion, as well as freedom of belief, religion, and conscience, as some examples, are guaranteed also to non-Germans. Furthermore, above all, Article 1 lays down that the dignity of man, not of citizens, but of men, is inviolable, and that, quote, the German people therefore acknowledge inviolable and inalienable human rights as the basis of every community or of mankind, of peace and of justice in the world. This acknowledgement demands for an internal attitude, for a specific ethos. Consequently, the German Constitution, which derives its claim of validity from the will of the democratic sovereign, the constitutive people, transcends the exclusivity and particularity of the political community already in its first article of the Constitution. The records of the Parliamentary Council, which developed the Basic Law, the Grundgesetz, in 1949, support this understanding of the guaranteed human rights. Interestingly, in a discussion of the Fundamental Committee in this Parliamentary Council, Delegate Professor Mangold referred to the preamble of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Thereupon, the Commission chose the quoted formulation for paragraph 2 of Article 1, taking on the tone of the declaration, what is a nice example for the migration of constitutional ideas widely discussed now in legal and political science. As a result, in the German Constitution, the German people clearly binds themselves normatively to human rights. Here, a moral demand for an internal attitude is expressed. This is reflected in the use of the German word Bekenntnis, confession, which requires a respective inner conviction. I think that the translation here provided by the Federal Ministry of Justice is a little bit weak in this regard, and that the German people acknowledge human rights is lesser than to say confess, yeah? So, admittedly, moral duties cannot be expressed as legal duties. Of course, we do know legal duties. the duty to send the children to school, to pay taxes, to obey the law, compulsory military service, and in some states even compulsory voting. However, these duties determine a specific behavior. They form rules of conduct. Desirable inner convictions cannot be constitutionalized in a legally enforceable way. In the aftermath of German reunification, the Basic Law was overhauled, and in the debate, one proposal was introduced to anchor a constitutional provision declaring that everybody has an obligation for humanity and public spirit. Not surprisingly, this proposal was turned down for reasons of not being legally enforceable. However, I think moral demands in the form of an appeal can indeed be fixed within legal text, and so it is done in the UN Declaration or in the Basic Law. As mentioned above, the moral claim for validity, does not address legally constituted institutions, but interpersonal relationships. Apparently, within the last 2 years, many people met this claim in face of the neediness of many refugees by proactively undertaking responsibilities which are normally fulfilled by public institutions. And one can debate whether this Willkommenskultur was an act of mercy or was rooted in religious semantics or in a feeling of compassion or was an act of justice due to the unjust world order mirroring in German foreign policies, which is all this has been discussed in Germany at least. However motivated now, this exceptional situation of receiving and taking care of hundreds of thousands of refugees entering Germany across open and uncontrolled borders could only last limited time. Accordingly, Herfried and Marina Münkler argue that there is a limit to the intake capacity, a limit what a people can take, which they, however, do not derive from physical considerations, but stress that the critical resource of social trust in the sense of a societal identity, that this is the essential resource. And this resource, they underline, is indeed finite, but it is elastic and can be invested in. This leads directly into a German domestic political debate. How can those who perceive foreigners as a threat to their homeland identity politically be paid attention to by having a sympathetic ear for this citizenship without indulging xenophobia and racist resentments? It remains to be seen what is set on the agenda of the new German Department of Interior and Heimat, Homeland, in this regard. Such a debate on identity takes place in the recent Bavarian controversy, whether one should request respect for the prevalent guiding culture, Leitkultur, from the incoming, as the Christian Social Union first claimed to include to the state constitution, and later to a new immigration law. So that's now the law that the incoming migrants should behave according to a guiding culture. Yeah. Or rather demand a commitment to a constitutional patriotism from all residents, also binding the old citizens, what usually is the answer of the political left to this claim. Constitutional patriotism, however, does not lead the way to a cosmopolitan or border-crossing world society. Rather, this concept reveals that the key point is the complementarity of particular belonging and universal values, as it is laid down in the German Basic Law and in many, many other constitutions, and as it meets the level of reflection and normative horizon of modernity. The notion of constitutional patriotism requires belonging. Belonging, in turn, as a dimension of personal identity, requires demarcation. I agree with the statement that anthropologically we still rely on forming our identity, in particular belonging. Only in a situation of rootedness in a concrete and historically situated society, citizens take over responsibility for public welfare and at the same time receive a normative impulse to engage by a universal value orientation. Thus, a complementarity of universal human rights and particular democratic citizenship in a reflexive concept of constitutional patriotism has to be acknowledged. The question which must concern us then is to ask for the modi of political integration and formation of a collective political identity. Against the background of persistent migration in the 21st century, this identity cannot only and not primarily arise from a community of remembrance anymore. Moreover, the formation of a collective political identity in an experience and communication-based community must develop now new handling of cultural diversity. The respective chances will be evaluated differently. The ones who tend to have a skeptical perspective on the readiness for solidarity within democracy will come to rather restrained conclusions, while those who stress recurrently activatable republican potentials will draw a more optimistic picture. So let me now come to an outlook. It became clear that there is a need for political debate within citizenship, clarifying what the normative self-binding to human rights should practically mean today. Here, this can only be touched upon. I think at the ground, we should try to differentiate the types of migrations. Refugees fleeing from civil war countries and asking for help, asylum seekers who are discriminated individually for various reasons in their homelands, religious, political reasons, or sexual orientation reasons, and third, labor migrants. First, in face of continuous migration and flight, it must be discussed how border regimes and entry control can develop. Second, regarding labor migration, a political debate is required with view to which entry criteria should be applied and how these criteria are to establish in an immigration law. This is another issue than the answer needed to flight and expulsion, since labor migration constitutes an exchange deal whereby the conditions for this deal are set by the receiving states. States grant entry and possibly citizenship for what the society expects the migrants to provide for the common good. Generally, in consideration of the deterritorializing of border control within the EU, it must be kept in mind that this key point of state sovereignty became a subject already of supranational politics and legal obligation. In this regard, I came across the European Court of Justice decision in spring 2017, where the court issued a decision on the issuing of humanitarian visa in embassies and consulates outside the EU territory is the responsibility and thus the sovereignty of member states, since there is no respective EU law on which the Charter of Fundamental Rights and the European Convention of Human Rights, with its rights of asylum and principle of non-refoulement, could be applied to. If the request of Attorney General Paolo Mengozzi had been successful, it could have revolutionized the European asylum system and system of subsidiarity protection. In this case, refugees would no longer be forced to cross the external EU border with the help of smugglers on illegally dangerous and tragically often deadly dangerous routes, but could legally enter and seek asylum in an EU country with a visa. Indeed, this regime of shifting borders, as Ayelet Shachar has called it, would have triggered consequential problems, but would have released the ethically problematic shielding of external borders at our EU border system. Surely, also in this case, not all claims for asylum would have been approved, since this is not politically feasible within a democracy, what I tried to show. Consequently, if on the one hand European citizenries are not willing to accept as many refugees as entered not only Germany but also Austria and Sweden in autumn 2015, but on the other hand, the morally and legally rooted duty following human rights shall not be mere rhetoric. The governments must heavily enhance their efforts to combat the causes of flight and migration. I think this includes humanitarian interventions. This includes another foreign policy towards the Arabian world. This includes a very different form of development aid, which does no longer stabilize corrupt regimes in African states, as well as fair trade agreements, which allow for value creation outside the European Union. Obviously, to this end, not only a moral, but in the first place, an intensive political debate is needed. So, the question posed at the beginning, asking for the paradoxical and tensed relation, cannot be resolved to the one or the other side. An exclusive emphasis on universal human rights would ignore the protection and freedom-guaranteeing function of state order based on states' borders. And one-sided attention to the rights of the democratic sovereign and its want for border demarcation would be blind for the already given state of delimitation due to functional interdependence and would overlook the normative constitutional self-binding to human rights. I think that is all political theory can do, to shed light on these kind of paradoxes in which the real political world is wrapped. Thank you so much.